Finance Committee to order. Today, we're taking up three bills having to do with the energy program for Alaska. The first bill is House Bill 684, which appropriates $35 million to help with debt service and rate stabilization for the four dam pool projects. HB 589, so-called APA management bill, makes statutory changes to enable the four dam pool projects to go forward successfully. And HJR 57, which establishes a major projects fund with the Susitna project and statewide power cost assistance as the primary uses for the fund. Right now, we have Larry Crawford, who's chairman of the Alaska Power Authority, on the teleconference hookup from Anchorage. And he's requested to testify first on these bills. So if Mr. Crawford is on the line, we'll hear from Mr. Crawford in Anchorage.
He's approaching the mic, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Cowdery, you want to come up and join us up here?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, it's fine, Mr. Crawford.
I had sent down to Juno a set of slides that we were supposed to show down there while I was talking from them here, but the plane did not make it in. So I will do the best I can here with the material I have. The two bills, I assume, that we have before us are House Bill 589, and that is the committee substitute that passed out of the Resource Committee. And then House Bill 684. Those are the two bills.
Excuse me, I was being distracted by one of my committee members here. Would you state that question again, please?
Okay, the two bills are committee substitute for House Bill 589 and the committee substitute for House Bill 684.
That's correct.
I think that it's worthwhile, just as a couple of introductory comments, that the four dam pool negotiations that are going on and the two bills that represent the necessary legislation to bring that about, I think it's important to note that it's not a separate issue, really. It's part of the whole overall energy program for Alaska. And in order for the energy program to move forward in a expeditious way, we need to have power sales agreements with these communities. And without these two pieces of legislation, the communities are unwilling to enter into power sales agreements. So I'll go through just a little bit in terms of the way and manner in which legislative changes were arrived at, and then a little bit in terms of the manner in which the $35 million was derived. And then I'll talk a little bit about the status of the negotiation. But as far as the four dams that are involved in this, the Solomon Gulch project is completed. It's been online for some time. The Swan Lake project in Ketchikan is being tested. The Tai'i project in Petersburg and Wrangell has been tested, and I either will be in testing again today or soon. The Terror Lake project is a little ahead of schedule, and it looks like a September 1984 completion date for Terror Lake. So the projects are, three of them are one of them is operational, two of them are close to being operational, and the fourth is coming along nicely. As far as the difficulty we've had in these negotiations, I think is really a result of a number of changed conditions from the date that these projects were originally conceived. And there was a commonly held belief that most of these projects, if not all, would be 100% state funded, and that there would be no need to go to the bond market, which is the case today. The diesel fuel costs have not escalated in the manner that was being projected at the time. The utilization of the project is not as high as had been anticipated. So this has changed to a large degree the manner in which we've approached these projects. And it's taken a lot of time and a lot of discussion with the communities. The areas that we have discussed from almost the very beginning are there are five major areas. One has to do with the repeal of the SITNA clause. The second area has to do with the repealing the prohibition on the industrial rate. The fourth area that we've talked a lot about is operation and maintenance and who will do it. I think we're getting close to agreement on that. The last two items, the cost of power and the system increment, are still being discussed, and I think it's fair to say at this point we do not have consistent agreement among the communities. The requested legislative changes that are included in House Bill 589 are as follows. A repeal of the, quote, SITNA clause, a clause giving the power authority the ability to limit debt service impact from new projects. The third item is the repeal of the prohibition against the industrial rate. The fourth area is combining the debt service component for the four dams and treating them as one project for purposes of debt service. And then the last area, the fifth area, which is included in House Bill 684, is the rate stabilization fund. As far as the rate stabilization fund is concerned, which is House Bill 684, is the difficulty that we have with hydroelectric power rates is that they are higher in the early years, and then they begin to decline and they become more desirable in diesel generation in the out years. So what we have done is the approach that we have followed is kind of outlined, I think, in a chart that you have in your packet. And if you don't, George Matz is there from Commerce with copies of the chart.
We have that. Go ahead. It's right here.
Did you call me the one?
It's this one here.
Sit you down there, please.
Yeah, okay, Larry, you wanted to refer to this this chart?
Yes, I'd like to refer to the chart. The chart is headed up comparative cost of power.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. We have spent quite a lot of time working with the communities to develop the solid black line you see there that's labeled diesel. And this is the calculated amount of what it represents what the generation cost would be over a long period of time. The dotted line that you see starting from the back where it says cents per kilowatt hour, right where that dotted line starts down, it's labeled hydro, is a calculation of what it would look like if the communities were to pay the cost, all of the costs of the hydroelectric project. The little shaded area in there that's labeled rate stabilization is the area that represents the shortfall between what the hydroelectric costs are and what it would cost to keep the communities on the diesel alternative line. Now, that amount in that shaded area is the amount that is included in the House Bill 684, the $35 million. The other item that I referred to was, is the system increment, and that's shown there as a little dotted line right above the hydro line. System increment represents the amount that these four dams would, we could assess against these four dams for new debt service entering the system. So as new debt service entered the system, then the cost for power could be above the hydroelectric line. Now, we're negotiating at the present time what that amount would be, but we're looking at limiting the amount that it could increase in any given year to, let's say, X amount, X percent, and that it would not increase any more than Y percent over a period of years. So we're in the process now of negotiating what that line looks like. The rate stabilization fund itself is comprised of three things. $35 million state appropriation, a $12 million in bond proceeds that would represent additional borrowings that would be paid back in the later years, and then $14 plus million dollars in interest earnings on the $35 million and the $12 million. The way it's envisioned, this rate stabilization fund would be set aside in an escrow, so to speak, and would be drawn down according to some agreed upon amounts over the period of years that the rate stabilization is required to maintain the rates on a competitive basis with diesel. Now, the only other comment I have is on a system increment provision, we're trying to get some kind of return on a portion of the investment made in these facilities. The communities, of course, would prefer to have it as low as possible. The Power Authority is interested in an equitable amount so that some of this would be returned. In an indirect, the rate stabilization fund would be returned over time through this system increment. We have met this morning with the communities again. They have prepared for us a counter offer to offer that we have made to them. We are in the process now of evaluating that counter offer, and we plan to discuss it with the Power Authority Board tomorrow morning at 10, and I think the communities will be there as well to express their views as to where we are. So we are still basically in the process of talking about the two major issues, the cost of power and the system increment, and we have not at this time reached a point where the communities are ready to sign a power sales agreement. And that ends my testimony, Mr. Chairman. I'd be available here for comment or question. And we do have members of the finance team and a representative from R.W. Beck who did a lot of the costing of these proposals.
Okay, that's fine, Mr. Crawford. One of the questions that I have initially is that on this chart that you were referring to, where the diesel cost and the hydro cost cross each other, how many years out is that? That would be helpful for a number of us to get a better handle on this.
The number of years varies by community, but it varies anywhere from 5 years to 10 years.
Okay, then this crossover point is not the same for all the communities. How would it be if we put this four dam pool together and stabilize the rates among all the communities? Then would this come to pass at the same time or not?
What we've done here is a little of both. Basically, we've combined the debt service component for all of the four projects or the four dams, and each community pays the same amount of debt service. but the operation and maintenance costs are different on each project. And there was an unwillingness on the part of the communities to be, so to speak, responsible or have to worry about somebody else's operation and maintenance. So we've combined that service, but not operation and maintenance. So by doing so, each community's crossover is different. And the rate stabilization fund is different as well because each community's diesel alternative costs are different. They vary by community.
Okay, this rate stabilization fund that you referred to of approximately $35 million, that's basically a fund to pick up the cost differential in this first 5 to 10 years, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, who did you say you had there with you in case any of the members have questions?
We have representatives from Power Authority finance team. Our Don Grimes, our financial advisor. We have Tony Dean from Devine, and we have Steve McAleer from First Boston. We also have Jim Seagraves from R.W. Beck. And we also have bond counsel here if there are any questions having to do with the legality of any of this.
Okay, that's...
We have a number of the community representatives here from the various communities being represented in the Fort Dam pool.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Crawford. At this time, we'll see if there's any questions with any committee members. Representative Martin?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Crawford, I have a number of questions I thought it might be best to answer at one time rather than individually. First, I... agree that you inherit this problem, a real major problem that was born on previous agreements and previous cost projections. And one of those cost projections was diesel costs. And I was wondering how the chart that you present to us today differed from the chart that they were using in 78 and 79 to show the logic, supposed logic, of investing such large sums into our hydro monies for these areas. The next, if you can tell me, what were some of the original agreements that local communities gave us as to how they would fund these dams locally, and why is it that they're pulling out of it now? It seemed to me we had an ironclad agreement in the past. The other question would be, what projects were overrun and which one were on cost?
Yeah, did you hear that all right, Mr. Crawford?
Yes, I'll try to take them in order. Number one, I don't think, and I haven't been able to find any charts having to do with when these projects were originally conceived, but if there had been one, the diesel line would have been much deeper. And would have been, and the entry rate would have been higher. So the diesel line, the heavy black line on the chart would have moved up and the rate stabilization amount would have been smaller. The second question was, what happened to the commitments that these communities made earlier? I guess I'd have to say a lot of things have happened. Price of diesel hasn't gone up as expected. Some of the economies have not moved ahead in the way that it was envisioned. The load forecasts were, I think, a little optimistic at way back then. But I think a lot of it has to do with the reality of when you sit down and you start dealing with the details of should I buy power from this project, it's a whole lot different than when you sit back there several years ago thinking about how nice it would be to have a hydroelectric project and also when you see your diesel costs going up dramatically. So a lot of things have changed, and many of the decisions that the communities are making now are really, I would say, more business-oriented as opposed to political. So many of the concerns they have are business concerns having to do with the cost of power in their community. But I think we've learned something from this, and that is that the policy of the Power Authority at the present time is do not start a design on a project unless you have power sales agreements. because when you sit down and talk about details, things change than they do when you're talking about concepts. The other major thing was, I think many of them believed that the state would 100% fund these projects so that the rates would be lower than they are with debt service. The third question that you asked about overruns on the projects, there have been some projects that came in, and I guess the principal example would be TAI, that came in higher than some of the original cost estimates. I think some of that had to do with a couple of things. One is, I think maybe some of those earlier estimates may have been too low. They changed the scope of the project sometime back from what it was originally conceived to be, so that had increased the cost as well. And I guess that there were, you know, some overruns. It's hard to be specific about it because it's hard to go back in time. There were so many people involved, and then the Power Authority got into the act, and it's, the history is kind of vague.
That answer your question all right, Mr. Martin?
Not really, but
as good as you're going to get.
Could you yield me for a follow-up question on the diesel, just on the diesel law?
Okay, if you'll yield over here. Mr. Lindauer has a follow-up question on the same line.
Yes, Mr. Crawford, I would like to know what your assumptions are on your graph regarding the diesel fuel increase. Your graph has neither quantities specified on either the x-axis or the y-axis. I assume it's there merely to illustrate the point that there's a gap that you wish to fill with our money on behalf of whoever is going to benefit. I'd like you to tell me the basis for your projections of the diesel fuel prices. Is that a three-year straight line average in the past 3 years, or is it a 10-year average, or is it your guesstimate, or what is the statistical basis for your estimate on which you want this $35 million?
Yes, we have Jim Seagrave here from RW Beck to give you the amount.
Yes, sir, the diesel price is the diesel price that the communities each are currently paying fuel escalated at assumed escalation of 5.5% in the first 2 years, 6% in the next year, and 6.5% thereafter.
Then would it be correct?
Yes, and then at, starting in 1989, it goes up to 8.5% per year.
Mm-hmm. The assumption there was that diesel would not, there would not be any real increase to the price of diesel until 5 years, and then there would be a 2% real increase to the price of diesel. So we are escalating the price of diesel at projected inflationary, general inflationary increases for the first 5 years, and then adding a 2% real escalator beyond that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I want to continue to follow up on this question. Even though there are no notation, on no quantification on your graph, so it's really just an illustration, based on your testimony, it strikes me that you're asking for all of this money simply to offset projected increases in diesel prices. Is that correct?
That's the big component, but there are other components in there, and that is what the theory is here, or the principle here is that communities our principle here is the community should stay on the line that represents the cost of the diesel alternative until they reach the hydroelectric line.
Well, that's not my question. Let me rephrase my question and my interest again for you. If I understand your testimony to date, the sole purpose of this whole exercise and the reason that you want the $35 million is because you project diesel prices to be rising at 5.5% for 2 years, then 6%, then 6.5%, then 8.5%. Given the magnitude of the monies involved here, the total sum, if we had no increase in diesel prices, that you would not be here. If there was some reason you believe diesel prices were firm for that period of time, you would not be in. Is that correct?
No, basically, if there were no increases in diesel, then the amount would be larger. So if your diesel costs were continuing to decline or were flattened out, the rate stabilization amount would be greater because the heavy black line would be lower than it is right now. So what we were trying to do is to come up with a reasonable projection of diesel cost increases. And again, it was general inflation for 5 years and then a 2% real for the rest of the period. But anyway, if diesel costs were going down, then the line, the heavy black line, would be lower and the shaded area would be greater.
I would like you to send to the committee, this is John Lindargan, I'd like you to send to the committee the names of the people you contacted and the sources of your information regarding your diesel fuel price projection so that the committee can analyze this. Thank you.
I'd be happy to.
Okay, thank you. Next, we had John Cowdery, and then Dr. Fritz, and then Jim Duncan.
Yes, I was just a little bit, you stated earlier, this is Representative Cowdery, that the diesel costs vary from various communities, and I was wondering if that variance, is it minimal or major differences, or how much is it that it varies between the communities that we're talking about?
Are you talking about the price of diesel fuel or the cost of the diesel alternative?
The price of I understood that you said the cost of diesel.
Okay, the cost of diesel fuel did vary community by community, but the biggest difference was in Copper Valley, where they had a very favorable contract with MAPCO. But in terms of the diesel alternative line, it varied community by community as well, because some communities were maybe operating a little more efficiently. Maybe they had different kind of equipment. They didn't need to replace their equipment as soon. So in terms of the diesel electricity production costs, it varied community by community. Also, fuel costs were somewhat different.
Were they major differences or just minor? Or how would you describe the differences?
I would say that the differences are probably not major. The biggest difference is the lower costs at Copper Valley.
Thank you.
Dr. Fritz, you had a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Crawford, I come from the Kenai Peninsula, and one of our great dreams and our highest priority of power is the construction of the Bradley Lake Complex. What effect is this legislation going to have on the prompt construction of Bradley Lake?
It's my opinion that until we solve the four dam pool problem and move on with the energy program for Alaska, other projects are going to be affected, because we need to establish in the financial community that there is an energy program in Alaska and that it's moving forward. Now, as far as the impact of the legislative changes embodied in House Bill 589 and in House Bill 684, the requested legislative changes also would affect Bradley. For example, the repeal of the Susitna Clause. The Homer Electric, for example, would not be interested in a power sales agreement that had that would be subject to increase in 1991. So they would be similarly affected as these five communities are. They would like to be able to charge an industrial rate so that they wouldn't have to spill water. They could sell it at a favorable rate. The rate stabilization fund approach would be an approach that we would propose for the Bradley Lake project, as well as Susitna. We would propose also rate stabilization for the Susitna project, so that in the early years, the rates would be similar to their lease their current alternative. So specifically, this legislative change would relate directly to Bradley, and it would improve the Bradley Lake project situation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Duncan, you had a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple questions for Larry. I think I know the answer, but I want to be clearer that I do, Larry. First of all, let me just review what you said. Solomon Gulch is complete, and power is being sold to a couple communities. Is that correct?
In the case of Solomon, we are selling wholesale power. We are selling it at O&M rates, operation and maintenance rates, because there is no debt service in the system.
Okay.
But that is the only one at the present time that we're selling power to. Swan Lake and Tyee are still being tested.
But they'll probably be ready to produce power in the near future if sales agreements were negotiated. Is that correct?
Now, there's a little technicality there. Technically, we have an agreement on Swan Lake. We do not have any power sales agreements on Tyee with Wrangell or Petersburg.
But yes, there is an agreement with Swan Lake, which I guess the administration is now asking be renegotiated based on what is currently in statute. Is that correct?
That's correct. There was a statutory change, and we kind of made the policy decision that it would be beneficial for the entire energy program if we had similar agreements with all five communities.
All right. And Terror Lake will be completed in September of 1984.
That's correct.
Okay, Larry, I'm looking directly at committee substitute for House Bill number 589, the Resources Committee version. You have that, I guess.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
The as I read this version of the bill, Section 5 of the committee substitute does repeal what is now being called the Susitna Clause that was put into law in 1981. However, it makes that repeal effective upon the date that the voters of this state approve a major projects fund that is to build Susitna, or the Watonna Dam of Susitna. Let me ask you what the impact is on your ability to reach power sales agreements with these communities between now and November, assuming that's the date that's on the ballot. Because until that date, the Susitna Clause stays in effect. How are the communities reacting to that are involved in the Four Dam Pool? What's the effect on your ability to negotiate power sales agreements based on the fact that the Susitna Clause is being repealed in November instead of immediately?
That's a two-part answer. One is the communities are not interested in signing power sales agreements with the uncertainty associated with the Susitna Clause. In 1991, their rates could go up dramatically. They are concerned about that. So they are not interested in signing a power sales agreement with the Susitna Clause in effect. The second part to that is, in order for us to go to the bond market and sell bonds to retire the $200 million short-term debt, we have to have power sales agreements that are in place and that are long-term. If we have power sales agreements that are predicated on the outcome in November, the bondholder would not have much security to which places. In other words, there'd be a high degree of risk associated with these agreements. So, in order for us to move forward and retire the $200 million debt with a long-term instrument, we could not do that until after November.
So, as I understand your answer then, this does not solve the problem that you're facing with those people with the Four Dam Pool. A contingent repeal of this clause doesn't solve the problem. So what do you do between now and November while you're waiting for this question to be addressed by the voters? What does Swan Lake, what do those projects do? What do you do?
That's a question that difficult to answer because we will need to know the set of facts when legislation is in place. We have to know what set of facts we're working with. But currently, the way it is now, it calls into question what notes that we have. We have a $35 million note due in May. We have a $50 million note due in November. And in that period of time, these notes were conditioned on a long-term takeout. In other words, the holders of those notes were expecting us to retire them at those dates.
I guess, the short answer then is that this doesn't resolve the problem with the Four Dam Pool, this contingent repeal of the Susitna Clause. It doesn't solve the problem. It just may create a further problem between now and November, as I understand what you're saying. Let me ask you, I don't know if you agreed with that or disagreed with it, but that's what I understood you to say. Let me ask you a further question. What happens if the voters, if the major projects fund with the way it's presently written out of the Resources Committee is put on the ballot in November with the repeal of the Sitna Clause based on its passage and it fails? What if the voters don't approve that? What happens to the projects that are in the four dam pool?
If it fails, then the Sitna Clause would still be in effect, and we would not have power sales agreements. But that would be the short answer. The long answer is, in the meantime, between now and November, we have some short-term debt that we have to resolve. And I know that the legislature and certainly the administration does not want to be in a position of technically defaulted.
Let me ask you, do you think that if we pass committee substitute for House Bill 589 resources the way it's presently written, that we've solved the problem? I guess this is a yes or no answer, that we've solved the problem faced by Kodiak, Ketchikan, the Taiyi Project, Solomon Gulch, or have we just pushed off the solving of that problem to sometime in the future?
Short answer is no, the problem is not resolved.
Fine. May I ask you one other question, Mr. Crawford? On the Bradley Lake project that Representative Fritz was concerned about, assuming this legislation passed and the Sitna Clause was repealed, yes, Bradley Lake would benefit from that. However, if this legislation passes this way and then the Major Projects Fund passes with the language in it that dedicates the money directly to Wautauna, at least the way I read it, what's that do to Bradley Lake?
That's a kind of a difficult question, but because I would, nothing that I could see precludes Bradley from being funded outside of the Major Projects Fund. There's also an unallocated portion of the Major Projects Fund that could go to Bradley Lake. The effect of the SJR 57, I guess it is. The effect of that is to dedicate the 70% of the income stream to Wautauna. So it would be difficult to fund Bradley out of that source, but if other sources were found, Bradley could be funded.
Okay, so it would, Mr. Chair, if I may just pursue this. It would be difficult to fund Bradley Lake out of that source because 70% of it's dedicated to Wautauna and 10% of it's dedicated to the Power Cost Assistance Program, I believe, because that leaves you 20%. So we'd have to find other sources. Have you, or has anyone in the administration that you know of, run an analysis of revenue and expenditure forecast for the state so we can see if there would be available revenues outside of that for Bradley Lake? Do you know, are there other revenues available based on present revenue forecast?
Again, I think we're getting to a question of the willingness of the state to pay. I think that the state has the ability to. It'd be a question of whether the state is willing to, because I think the revenue projections are adequate to fund Bradley as well as Susitna. But it is a major commitment of funds, and it would be a major decision by the legislature.
Mr. Chairman, just to follow up on that, Mr. Crawford, and I'm going to suggest this to the people here who are going to testify for the administration also, but I would also suggest it to you that I think that it would be wise for the administration to do a revenue and expenditure forecast, if you haven't done one, to determine how much money is going to be left over as undedicated revenue. And the information I have, and I will make this available to the committee and the administration, the information I have is as you look at the revenue forecast the Department of Revenue has laid out for the next 15 years, you look at the dedication of the 25% of those revenues to the permanent fund, which is a constitutional mandate, you look at the possibility of an additional dedication of 10% of those revenues from the Major Projects Fund, that by fiscal year 1990, Mr. Crawford, you don't even have enough money to fund the operating budget. So I fail to see where you're going to get enough revenues to do Bradley Lake or any other project in this state if we're tying the hands of the legislature and the administration to the point where there's no available revenues left. And I would suggest that that's a very important consideration when we're considering this proposal and HJR number 57.
Do you care to comment on that, Mr. Crawford?
I agree that it's a major commitment of funds, but I guess it's a question that really I would not be able to answer. I think it's really a question between the governor and legislature as to how the monies would be allocated out over a period of time. It's really more of a resource allocation question.
Well, Mr. Chairman, yes, I'll conclude this because you don't have the information. I'll make it available to the committee. It is a question of resource allocation, I guess my point is I don't think the resources are there to allocate by constitutional dedication, especially when you add this 10% on. You're not going to be able to do Bradley Lake, probably. You're not going to be able to do some very basic needs around the state because the money is all put into a major projects fund, but we'll discuss that later. I just think that you and the Power Authority should be aware of that. I understand that OMB has done a projection on that. I've also had one prepared which may not agree with theirs, but... That's a very serious consideration and one I would hope the administration would testify to, and you also, Mr. Crawford, as the committees are considering this legislation.
Representative Duncan, we are in the process of updating our financial projections on both Susitna and Bradley, and we will be using projections from revenue and OMB and then looking at what that does to the revenue stream.
Okay, that concludes your comments, Mr. Duncan. And I would caution the members, we only have this teleconference hookup for about the next 15 minutes, so if we can keep our questions brief, well, it'll help all of us get all the information we can. Mr. Martin's next.
Representative?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Pettisport. Mr. Crawford, I only had one question left for now. Has the APA consulted with the Permanent Fund Board and see... the potential financial arrangement that could be done through them? I guess we're called investing in Alaska.
I have discussed with Dave Rose the possibility of monies being used to invest in these projects. The constraint that he is operating under is that he has to receive basic a competitive rate. What we are looking at is a tax-exempt issue, and we're trying to get a tax-exempt interest rate. So the last information I got from him is that the permanent fund would probably not be able to invest in these projects at the 10.5% or whatever the tax-free rate would be.
Representative Malone, would you care to join us up here at the table? We got an extra space. You're welcome. Okay, next was Mr. Ewing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A brief question to Larry Crawford in regard to a recent letter that was sent to the Senator, to the Senate President, notifying the legislature of $50 million in bonds for the Swan Lake project. Perhaps you could comment on this and the reasoning behind this amount of money.
Don Grimes, the National Advisory to the Authority, and with First Southwest Company. The letter was just the letter of intention to issue bonds, which utilize the moral obligation mechanism that's provided for in the statute. The amounts were chosen just as $250,000 for the four dam pool, but also $250 million for the four dam pool, but also $50 million on Swan. But you wouldn't use both. It was. It's not now known exactly whether we're going to have to try to extend the market note, or whether the four dam pool will be able to be concluded, the loan term financing for the four dam pool. The amounts were just rounded upward to provide for any necessary reserve funds, and the actual amount used would be just what's necessary, as the letter states. It would only be the amount necessary. It was just a a rounding upward to a level that would accommodate any kind of reserve funds and issuance costs and so forth. The actual amount would be determined upon determination of need.
And then, Mr. Chairman, just a follow-up question. And this would be to Larry Crawford. Has the administration or the Alaska Power Authority in any way, shape, or form looked in the possibility of appropriating that $35 million to pay off that first note, possibly the $50 million on the second note that is due this year before the constitutional question would come up if we were going to put this House joint resolution, if it was passed, either the House joint resolution or the Senate joint resolution were passed, if we could, essentially we need to... Is there any way that we know that this amount of money is going to be appropriated, or if we're going to appropriate anything in that direction?
To answer your question, we haven't considered that approach. Because we have always considered the solution to be an adequate bridge stabilization fund, and we were always considering the repeal of the Cessna clause. Should the Cessna clause not be repealed and this thing is delayed until November, then that would require some resolution to the $80 million worth of $85 million worth of debt that's due by November. And but no, we have not.
As to the users populations on this four dam pool, does the speakers have any idea of the numbers of user populations that will be getting power from the four dam pool umbrella there?
Did you get the question, Mr. Crawford? The question was, is how many people in Alaska does these four projects involve? In other words, it'll serve what percentage, what numbers of people?
I think it's somewhere around 36,000 is the number that is in my mind. That's about right.
Is that
36,000?
Yeah.
Okay, that's about $1,000 apiece. If you're going to figure it that way.
That concludes your question?
That's all I wanted to know.
Bob, is that people or customers?
People.
People in the area.
Probably. It would be people. Consumers would be less than that because there are more than one.
Yeah.
You know, household size is probably people. Around three.
Yeah, that's the point I was trying to make.
Right.
We're pitching off a grant.
Okay, next, Mr. Lindauer, you had another question?
I have a series of questions, Mr. Chairman, and I'd like the permission to follow through and
proceed, please.
Follow up. Mr. Crawford, tell me if I understand this correctly. My understanding is that if additional money from the administration of the Power Authority prior to your arrival was spent to cover those costs, we're going to have to sell more bonds than we expected. That the coupons on those bonds are such that power would have to be sold at a higher price than the diesel. The compounding your problem is you have some short-term notes which you are unable to refinance, or you think you're going to have trouble refinancing. Is that correct? Is a summary?
Okay. Yes, it's correct. The additional costs associated with these projects are more than just some of the overruns. It's really a question of the diesel, price of diesel, and a number of other factors.
Okay.
That is correct that the amount is required to stabilize the rates in the communities at an amount that's competitive with their diesel alternative.
Okay, now to follow that up, your problem with the short-term notes, can you give me the names of the banks who hold those, and can you tell me whether those were originally placed with a guarantor and then there were subsequent resales with a guarantee? Who holds the notes?
I'll let Tony Dean answer that. He was involved in that.
This is your major problem. I would certainly hope you know the names of the banks that you owe the money to.
I know the names of the banks. It's Morgan Guarantee and Bankers Trust. I wanted to have Tony give you some of the details.
I don't need the details, Mr. Crawford. I just want the names of the banks. Have you made an effort and been rejected in an effort to roll those notes over?
Talked to Morgan Guarantee, and we gave him one set of facts. The set of facts was that we were nearing, we were negotiating agreements, that we were making progress, and that we hoped to have an agreement sometime before the note was due.
He didn't answer.
That set of facts, they were,
we'll get it.
Were amenable to some kind of an extension. Under the set of facts that we're talking about now, I don't know that they would.
You haven't even, in other words, you have not even proposed the rolling over of these notes yet that are the basis for this whole scenario that we're starting. Is that correct?
I have not approached the bank to notes under the current scenario with the November effective date, with the November contingency date.
Well, I would suggest that you certainly should approach those banks immediately, and you should get back to the Finance Committee with their answers, and I would certainly hope you to approach them on both a rollover on a short-term basis and also the terms and conditions for a long-term basis, and their responses. I'd like to see their responses in writing so that I can prepare amendment legislation relating to those institutions if that's necessary. I think you'll find that that possibility will take care of your short-term problem, so I'd like to go on and deal with your bonds.
Mr. Dean, Tony Dean from John Devine & Company, you have had continuing conversations with Morgan Guarantee Bank and Bankers Trust. I think something should be very important here. Morgan Guarantee Bank of New York holds as agent bank on their own behalf and on behalf of three other banks, Idaho National, Rainier National, and National Bank of Alaska, $35 million. Their position has been that they lent the money. The money was due on May 31st of 1984, and they expect repayment.
Excellent. This is John Lindauer again. How much money of ours from the Permanent Fund, ADA, the General Fund, and so forth do those banks have on deposit that we can talk about? Do you have any idea?
All I want to indicate. Now, let me just indicate one other thing, which is, with respect to the other notes, $165 million of other notes, which are not held by any banks. They are guaranteed by, under a letter of credit, Bankers Trust, the Mellon Bank, and First Interstate Bank. The bank, the notes, the actual paper, is held by a variety of institutions all over the United States.
I understand the relationship between correspondent banks and the bank that handled the transaction, the primary servicer of that. I would like you to send to the committee so that we can evaluate it along with their letters of refusal the amounts of money from the state of Alaska that they have on deposit that you're obviously discussing with them at the same time you're discussing these notes. I think you'll find that you'll be able to work something out. If not, then if you'll just send us the facts, we'll try to work something out for you. I'd like to talk to you about the bonds. Have you or have you not attempted to sell bonds with coupons that would stabilize the local rates? And if you have, who have you offered it to?
We have not tried to sell bonds at this point because we have to have put the deal together so it's a dual deal. And we have to have agreements from the various communities before we can approach the market. I think you may be referring to creeping coupons, and I'd let the financial advisor address that.
Mr. Stanis Grimes again. We are not able to enter the market until we have the details of financing put together, as Mr. Crawford indicated. Such time as we are, which this piece of legislation is an integral part of being able to go to the market, we will evaluate what is the best type of financing technique to use for the financing. And let me just speak specifically to the coupon or calling coupon or whatever you wish to call it, increasing rate coupon. We are also a financial advisor on another state agency, Texas Housing Agency, which is a major issuer of bonds. We had five issues last calendar year totaling $325 million, one of which was an extremely large single-family mortgage housing revenue bond, $238 million. And we reviewed the zero coupon or the capital appreciation bond in connection with that financing, which was, it involved seven co-managing underwriters and an underwriting group of over 100 dealers across the country. And to make a long story short, the amount of the issue that was handled by the zero coupon technique was approximately $6 million in proceeds out of $238 million. And the way we determined the amount was how much of that particular type of unusual credit, unusual bond, that unusual technique.
Yeah, it's so unusual that that's not what we're proposing here.
Yes, a rate that was cost effective.
Okay, this is John Lindauer again. That's very unusual, a bond, all right. It's so unusual, it's not what I'm talking about. I asked you, and I think the answer is no, you have not attempted to sell bonds. I think you testified earlier that the communities would be satisfied if they could maintain their current level of utility rates. Is that correct?
See, that was the answer, that we are trying to match their current expected cost of energy, yes.
Yes, okay. If that's true and you have an income stream, then you also know the magnitude of the coupons that you could offer to the market. And you obviously have not even taken the time to offer those coupons to the market. So I have a second question for you. Are you dealing as a sole source, or do you intend to, with a sole source placement, or do you intend to offer these competitively into the money market? Do you have a sole source contract?
All right, Crawford, I'd like to address the first part. In the first place, are unable to go to the marketplace without our sales agreements, without enabling legislation, without the whole package together. So it would be somewhat of a waste of our time to even be talking about that at this point, because we don't know what the deal looks like. As far as the second part of your question, I'll let John Grimes answer that.
I believe the second part of the question was this sole source, or was this what kind of marketing technique? The way that the financing is structured is that, of course, we are a state agency, and this agency went through an RFP procedure during the selection of the finance of the managing underwriters some 3 or 4 years ago, and they have been working with the authority on various
sole source
financial matters. The bonds will be offered. The best possible rate. It is our job as financial advisor to review any bond purchase contract that is presented for the consideration of the authority and to advise the authority on current market conditions and other bond issues in the market at that time, and to evaluate the
sole source
of that offer. And it will be our job to show the board other issues that are in the market, other fees that are being charged, and to recommendation.
Okay, that answers the question. You have a sole source contract based on an RFP of some years ago, and you have not attempted to sell bonds with coupons which continue the current rates. You apparently have at least a verbal agreement from the communities, so you are capable of going into the market. You could, in fact, put the bonds together with those rates, and you could, in fact, issue them. So I wonder why we are sitting here going through this, and why we have panicked those communities and think their rates must go up until you get turned down. And since you haven't been turned down, why are we here?
Representative, we basically cannot go to the marketplace without signed power sales agreements to guarantee the revenue stream. We cannot go to the marketplace without a deal that is put together, without legislative authorization in the form of these two bills. We cannot do anything unless we have a package that we can sit down and discuss and describe and market. To go out now would be a representation of us not being prepared to do the deal.
Well, I think you're certainly not prepared. I'll buy that.
Detrimental to us.
Okay, Mr. Lindauer, We have a couple of more people that want to comment, members of the committee, and we're not going to pass these bills out or take any action on them today. This has been a good exchange. We're over our time on a teleconference, so I'm going to take a couple of more questions. Then we're going to move on to another piece of legislation for other people that are here that want to testify. So, if I may go on to the next person, Mr. Malone.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had one question, which is, I'm sure the information is available, but in the early years of the four-dam pool, what are the revenues, gross revenues run, power revenues run approximately?
At what rate?
Well, what they're proposing to the communities.
I don't have that information really available. I can get it for you.
What were they?
Okay, thank you.
Did that satisfy your question, Mr. Malone?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, we had one other. Mr. Wanny, did you care to comment before we take testimony from the administration and others?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have questions for Mr. Crawford, but I think I would like to address some comments toward the legislation, if I could.
Okay, that's fine. Are there any other questions of Mr. Crawford?
If we're going to keep this teleconference going, I have some questions.
I'd rather not keep it going any longer for today. We'll have another opportunity. Okay, if there appears not, Mr. Crawford, unless you had a closing remarks, that'll conclude our teleconference hookup.
Okay, I would like to make clear one thing, that we are still in negotiations with the two communities. We're still talking about the amount of rate stabilization and the system increment provision. So the $35 million represents the proposal that we've made, and it's I will discuss with the board tomorrow the Power Authority's proposal.
Okay, very good, Mr. Crawford. Thank you for your testimony, and we'll sign off the teleconference network at this time. I believe while we're on this subject and it's still fresh in our minds, Mr. Heath from Revenue, representing either Revenue or possibly the administration, wanted to comment. Is that correct,
Mr. Chairman, are we going to hold these bills over?
Yes, we are.
I'd rather have this backup so we continue on in some kind of reasonable manner, so that I can review it so that I can ask proper questions of administration. I just did not have them testify until we have the backup on this. Then have administration come forward.
If that doesn't make any difference to you, Mr. Heath, you are here in June and would be available at another time or whenever the committee chose. Okay, without objection, then we'll close out the hearing on these three bills.
Mr. Chairman, could I ask a question? What backup are we waiting on now? Is it the stuff that Representative Lindauer's request?
That, in principle, and some of the other members asked other questions that we expect information from the Power Authority on, yes. Mr. Wendy.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'd like to respond to some of the comments made just in terms of the information that seems to be requested. First of all, I guess I'd like, Mr. Chairman, to point out that each of the projects is kind of in a different situation depending on where they were in development and how the statutes change in relation to the development of the hydroelectric projects and their relationship with the Power Authority. It is clear that there are existing power sales agreements and other agreements associated with the Swan Lake project in Ketchikan. There has been agreements under which power is being sold on Solomon Gulch. Tai'i and Terror Lake do not have any signed power sales agreements. I'd like to address the two in my district to the extent that some of the comments early referred to by Representative Martin. First of all, the city of Ketchikan owned the project to begin with. They had the FERC permit and initiated development of their project and essentially deeded the project over to the state of Alaska and signed agreements acquisition agreements and agreements that dealt with the method in which power would be sold and how much power would be sold. I'd inform the committee that the city of Ketchikan is prepared to stand by those agreements.
What's the next bill?
But the fact and the way the problems have developed is in 1981, the state of Alaska changed the statutes that put those agreements, make those agreements non-consistent with state statute, and the state is insisting on changing the power in existing agreements. So essentially, in this instance, the state of Alaska is backing out of agreements that were signed earlier on. Nevertheless, recognizing the change in the power authority program since that time, they're entering these negotiations. So I don't want anyone here to believe that in regard to the development of the sale of power, that community is backing out of commitments made. They will stand by the documents that they signed on the dotted line. Tai, on the other hand, does not have any signed power sales agreements. That's where the overruns that are within the system exist, and there are significant differences in what the people thought that program would cost going into it compared to how the power authority has developed. So I think you'll find similar situations for Solomon Gulch and Kodiak on Terre Lake, but I wanted to make the existence of those situations very clear. The other thing, I don't think anyone doubts that we can roll those notes over. The information I would hope this committee would pursue in terms of the impact of that decision, however, is what the cost for doing that will be. And the Resource Committee had substantial information on that aspect, and I would think it would be incumbent upon this committee to specifically look at that, and I sense that that's the type of information that you specifically want.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Wente. That'll close out our comment on the group of power bills. And the next bill before the committee today is House Bill 599. The prime sponsor is Representative Cowdery. This bill would require the Board of the Alaska Permanent Fund to invest annually within the state of Alaska from 10% to 20% of the fund assets until such time as 50% of the total corporate assets are invested within the state of Alaska. The Permanent Fund Corporation has submitted a fiscal note which attempts to explain the fiscal impact of this bill. After we hear from the prime sponsor, Mr. Cowdery, we have here to testify on this bill Mr. Tom Fink and Mr. Dave Rose of the corporation. With that, Representative Cowdery, would you care to make your opening remarks on House Bill 599?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on this bill. I'd like to address you today on a situation I think needs corrected, and that we're not being allowed to use our own money. I think we have $5 billion that belong to the citizens of this state, and that we're only using a small percentage of it to get the maximum benefits to those citizens. I'm speaking, of course, Mr. Chairman, of the Permanent Fund, the Alaska Permanent Fund, the bill that's before us today, and I think that bill corrects the problem. This bill directs that the Alaska Permanent Fund Board of Trustees invest at least 10%, but not more than 20% of the fund right here in Alaska. And I think these investments would continue until we've utilized half of the fund in state. I'm not talking about spending the money on unprofitable ventures, or if the investment doesn't meet the criteria of other investors, then we shouldn't do it. Shouldn't be in it. But by definition, the word investment means to put money into business, real estate, bonds, or for the purpose of making money. And that's what we're doing outside the state right now. And I think we should be able to do that in state. a lot of has been made of the permanent fund of vesting money in Dallas or other cities besides Alaskan cities. A lot has been made of it because it's news, and it's news because people listen. It gets their attentions. They're not satisfied with it. I think it makes people mad because it's their money, and they don't want to see anyone else using it unless they have an opportunity of using it themselves, and I think this bill would give them that opportunity. I'd like to make my point perhaps that if with an analogy that if, say, if you've got some money and you want to invest and you give it to someone who you trust, maybe that's a member of your staff. Your staff knows that, say, maybe I, myself, personally, have made money on other investments, so that staff person gives it to me and says, here, make me a profit. So I take the money and start using it. Then someone else from your family comes along, maybe your wife, and says, hey, I can give you just as good a deal or maybe even a better return. Let me use that. And then somebody else on your staff that originally says, no, we think it's better with John Cowdery. Well, I think it should be perhaps with that analogy in mind that they're investing it outside, and perhaps that we should bring it out. Maybe John Cowdery was the one that was investing it outside in this analogy, but I think we ought to bring it back to the citizens. I think recent polls in my district, I've asked them how they felt about this bill, and a vast majority thought it was a good idea. And why aren't we doing it now? I think it's only fair to say that there were a few people who were against the bill, as written. They wanted to invest all the money in the state, not just half of it. I think we keep hearing that by investing outside, we get a better deal. Mr. Chairman, I'd say it's time to take a look at what we call a better deal. If we invest in a Dallas construction project, we certainly get a money return on that investment. But if we invest in the same type of project in Alaska, we not only get a return on the investment, but we get the project. So whether it's that project, whether it's building a shopping center or housing, which would put Alaskan workers together to work, or who earn wages, who spend them in Alaska business, or and who would pay the Alaskan taxes, I think that them taxes would go into the coffers, adding to our economy. And I think the ripple effect of those funds flowing in the Alaska economy would be an indirect dividend check to so many Alaskans. And I'd like to point out, in December of last year, the average prime interest rate in Alaska was 11 cents. And if you take into consideration that most businesses pay 2.5% to 3% over that, I'd say that we can find some good investments right here. And I know we have a long, and I have more testimony, but I would just maybe perhaps like to leave it there. We have other people here to testify, and I just cut my testimony short if I'm sure it'd make everybody happy.
Thank you, Representative Cowdery. Are there questions of Representative Cowdery from members of Vernon? From
Thank
Mr.
you.
Hulbert?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just quickly like to ask a question here on this prudent man rule. I notice here it says investment policy by Alaska Permanent Fund Board overemphasizes conservative investment policy to the exclusion of many sound investments that could be made within the state. That's the part that bothers me about this. Now, if it's not a prudent investment, I mean, Alaska shouldn't be emphasized on. I mean, just because it's in Alaska. I've noticed in recent years, we've had so much money floating around Alaska that you can't even get a decent bid on an airport job or anything. I mean, it's just almost rose geometrically with the amount of money we had by the influx of more money in this state. You think them would be sound economic investments?
Well, I think that certainly if you dumped 50% of the fund into the state's economy at one time, you'd be too many dollars chasing too few projects, I think is what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with that. That's why the bill restricts it down to only to 10% or 20 maximum per year until 50% of the fund is in the state, invested in the state.
That's just 5 years, though, isn't it? I mean,
that's right. That's true.
That's what kind of bothers me. I mean, there's just so much that this state can absorb. We're throwing $600-800 million a year in capital projects. The operational budget is dumping all, at least half of that must, or two-thirds of that must be going directly to the state. And then here comes another big push. That's
a lot of the projects that we're in, the construction jobs that we're, the construction projects that we're creating is being financed by bonds. A lot of it's not by direct appropriation. Last year, I think road bonds by the municipality of Anchorage went for sold for 10.2%. I think the last school bond sold in this Juneau district went for 9.6. Last road bonds in Fairbanks, I think, was a little over 8. And so, I'm not saying we're going to add new jobs or new. I'm just saying that when we borrow money for in some of the in the history of the past and pay more for when we borrow money for bonds than we get in the return of the fund, I think that perhaps it would be the best investment would be to buy them bonds for the project. If it's not a prudent investment, certainly the Alaska Housing Finance, now that was one. Now there's some, I think that the permanent fund board went to tried to buy some of that here a few years ago, and or maybe it was last year, and I think that they was only able to get their hands on about $1.5 million of that. Mm-hmm. And because it was such a popular thing, and buying the bonds company doesn't finance the housing. We do that by appropriation, you know.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm saying. I think there's plenty of investments in state that we, rather than pay the commissions that's involved in doing all these transactions or running through two or three individuals, I think they're right here in state.
Yeah, I wouldn't have no problem putting money into this to help leverage money like we're doing there and all that, but it's just... I would hate to have this used on top of it. I just...
I don't have any intention. I don't think that this would. It would only replace what we're doing now.
Okay. That's
the thing.
Thank
you. Okay, no more questions. Appearing, thank you, Representative Cowdery.
Thank you for your
time. Mr. Rose, would you care to testify next?
Just have one question.
Okay, and a couple of commissioners have asked to testify a little later. So we have one question, Mr. Rose. Mr. Martin?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Rose. I just have one burning question. It's been burning for about 5 years. Why is it we don't invest in Alaska, like even our mortgage home loans? It seems to me that we're forcing the people to pay an extra percentage by the time it goes through the system, and that if it's 2 or 3% that we can save instead of bonding out of state and through our own banks, why not through the permanent funds?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Martin, we do have a home mortgage program, and that home mortgage program is based on a market rate of return. That program's been open for about 2 years, and yet only about 3/8 of it has been utilized. And the reason is that the rate at which loans are made are market rates, as opposed to Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, of course, which offers subsidized rates. We don't compete with Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, and therefore the people who prefer to use the permanent fund rates are those who want to buy more expensive homes which are over the limits of Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. But we have had an ongoing home mortgage program for 2 years.
Just to follow, Mr. Chairman, would it not be cheaper then to shut down Alaska Housing and put all of our mortgage under your programs?
Well, I couldn't comment on that. The fact of the matter is that you're appropriating funds out of the general fund to subsidize Alaska Housing Finance.
Yes.
I'm not sure there'd be a saving because we would still want to get market rates. That subsidy would still have to be appropriated and still have to flow to the permanent fund.
It wouldn't be a less subsidy then. Because it seemed like the homeowner, eventually we helped them, but because of the inflated cost and the inflated percentage that goes around the horn, everybody gets a part of it. We had a direct relationship with permanent fund board, we would save money. You wouldn't necessarily have to make 11% or 10%. 9% would be very beneficial, and the person wouldn't be spending as much. And not subsidizing, it's kind of an indirect way that they're not saving money.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the market rate for housing loans in today's market is 12.25%, and that's the rate that we make them at. Unless there was a mandate to provide rates at cut rate, mm-hmm. the permanent fund would not do that. It would only invest at market rates.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, did you have a quick question?
Yes,
make it quick.
Yeah, just a quick question. On your March 6th memo or information to Representative Adams on the second page, you said that a representative from one of Alaska's largest banks testified that most banks were awash with funds and that the program would not be used. I was wondering what bank that was.
The testimony was from National Bank of Alaska.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Fink, I believe you wanted to testify on this bill, 599.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Could you give your...
Tom Fink.
Thank you.
President of Anchorage. For a good number of years, I've been trying to get the state to invest a permanent fund in Alaska, so I'm tickled that there are several bills that introduced this session. The constitutional amendments, which I don't think is the correct way. I think the statutory way of the bill before you is more correct. The bill that's before you, I think, is a step in the right direction. I don't think it goes anywhere near far enough because I think you'll find that the trustees will continue to frustrate the attitude, at least of the sponsors of that bill. They want some money invested in Alaska. And they're playing around with two words, prudent man and market rate. For example, you questioned prudent, and would you say that 8% on a real estate mortgage was prudent or not prudent, and that 4% on the stock market investment is prudent or not prudent? The only problem I'm trying
I'm
to explain
to
you.
I'm supposed to ask you questions. You're not. I don't know the answers.
Well, the permanent fund trustees estimate that they're going to make 4.17% on their common stocks, and they say that's prudent. That's a prudent investment. They make house loans. They've been making them in the end of January at an average return of 4.51%. They feel that 14.5% is prudent investment for market rates on real estate loans in Alaska, but they feel it's prudent to invest in common stocks at 4.17%. I just disagree with that interpretation of market and that interpretation of prudent man. Currently, for example, based on a newspaper article, they're going to accept house loans now at 12.5. Common stocks are to make 4.17. Commercial paper has to make around 9.38. Intermediate U.S. bonds have to make a little over 11. And short-term U.S. bonds have to make a little under 11. Now, they consider that market and prudent. Now, real estate loans at 8% in Alaska, or any investments in Alaska, other than those at 14.5%, are not prudent. So, the problem with this bill, or one of the several problems, I think when you try to limit the investment in the state to 10 to 20% of that in 1 year, you're creating a problem. Because if we invest in Alaska, it seems to me we have to invest in an area which affects as many people as possible, and we have to be able to saturate that market, take care of that entire market. We can't say we're going to make loans for hotels, for a new hotel at 10% and the old hotel is paying 14%. We can't do that. I mean, we shouldn't do that. So I'm afraid when you limit it to 10 or 20%, in that sense, you can't do what you ought to do. I think you've got to be able to commit more than that in one period of time. Secondly, unless you address the concept of market rates, or unless you address the concept of prudential, what's prudential, you will be frustrated. And not only, I say that because of my knowledge of the permanent trustees and the past trustees, but past experience of the legislature. Whenever we've directed the Department of Revenue back and we had the $900 million, we directed them to buy VA loans and small business loans. They never did it until we made it absolutely mandatory in statute. We said we'd like for them to do it. They may do it. We recommend it. We brought them before the committee and said, you're going to do it? Yeah, we're going to do it. Went home and never did. So we finally wrote a law that said they had to. So I think that you're going to have to, if you want to effectively get them to a loan in Alaska, you're going to have to give them direction and some criteria of what they ought to invest in. And if you allow them to continue their concept, their idea of prudent market rate, that 4.17 for common stocks is good and 8% for Alaskan real estate is bad, they're not going to do any investing in Alaska with any value. Essentially, Representative Hurlburt, they're not going to bring new money into the state. They're going to replace higher cost money that's already here. Now, Mr. Rose has said that they've had a house, you know, program to buy mortgages, but it's 14.5 now. It was 15.5. Well, of course there's nobody. Who wants to borrow 15.5%? Who can afford to make those payments? I'm surprised they got $30 million out on those kind of loans. You know, to me, the state is a whole, and you can't separate one little part of it. And if a good share of the state, like the Alaska Housing Finance, the biggest borrow we have, is paying 12, 13, 14%, and our big investment account, the permanent fund, is earning 11%. To me, that just doesn't show very much sense. I think a grade school economy class will tell you, you don't borrow at a rate higher than you invest. But that's exactly what we're doing. And all because the permanent fund trustees say, we're a separate entity, we don't worry about anything else, we're going to use our interpretation of prudent and our interpretation of market. And we don't care if Alaskans are paying 2% more for the money they use, as long as we follow our guidelines. So I hope that you make some progress this year towards directing the permanent fund trustees to invest in Alaska. Under the existing law, they essentially are directed to invest outside. I think it's the maximum they can put into residential loans, I think, is 15% at any rate. I mean, the way the current permanent fund law is currently structured, they could do better as far as Alaska's concerned, but not much. The law needs changing. Maybe I could respond to some questions.
Representative Hulbert, you had the question?
Yeah. I'm just going to kind of ask Tom here, is kind of a more of a projection into the future, philosophical, if you will. We make loans here based on the ability, I think the banks make loans on the ability to pay, and looking down the road, the ability to pay. Because these loans are 20 years, 25 years, 30 years. What bothers me is you look around Alaska, the employment around Alaska is almost on a short term. We have military bases, which who knows what that's gonna what's gonna change the defense structure. We have state spending, all predicated on oil revenues. Basically, I mean the tax structure sure couldn't support that. Most of the people making these loans are on almost an ungenuine economy. It's not. Alaska's economy is not a production economy except for oil, and that's non-renewable. That's not infinite. If we turn around and let the permanent fund finance these things rather than other risk takers, we're a risk taker. If we do that's what I'm. You understand what I'm trying to get at?
I understand, but I want to suggest to you.
So it's either you got to have complete faith that it's going to go on, or you kind of doubtful.
Well, I think you have to have as much faith in Alaska, at least, as you have in the rest of the country. Now, for example, you know, there are no cinches in investing. If you take the January 31 report of the Permanent Fund Committee, and they show you the estimated value of their investments, if they were to liquidate their investments on January 31, they'd take right at a $50 million loss. And the thing that might surprise you is they take $40 million of that loss in government securities. In other words, they've paid $4.376 billion, I think, for government securities, and the market value is $4.26 or $3.6, whatever it is. There's a $40 million loss. Because you're frowning, Dr. Fritz. When interest rates go up, your bonds in your portfolio, the value goes down. If interest rates go down, the value in your portfolio goes up. So I'm not saying they're making poor investments. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that they're not in the best interest of the people of the state of Alaska. They're not in the best interest of the prudent fund doctrine, in my opinion. They're going for higher yield, and they ought not to go for the highest yield. We're talking about a long-term thing. They ought to be satisfied with a good yield. People think the stock market, people make a lot of money. I can show you studies. Everybody can show you studies. But I can tell you, as of March of 83, in a magazine document put out by a stock brokerage firm, 15 years prior to that, you would not have made 7.5% money on your money in the stock market. You made a little under 7.5%. And I'm saying, you know, in the area, 8-9% real estate mortgage is a great loan, and we ought to make them. And any economy can go bad. Any investments can go bad. The stock market, I really believe they're going to take a bath. I think by this time next year, they're really going to have red faces, because I think their investment in the stock market is going to go down precipitously. They've already, you know, again, if they had to sell on December 31, they'd take a $2 million loss. But I think that's nothing compared to what's going to happen. And, you know, we've had experience on that. If you recall, after the $900 million, we bought $18 million worth of stocks and sold them a couple of years later for $13 million. So we've done the same kind of games with gold. Real sound, sensible people, when they handle government money, in my opinion, want to become fancy investors. And instead of the good old tried and true investments in your backyard, where you got a better idea of value. To copy this, I'll stop again. The three goals of the Alberta Heritage Funds, I think, just fit beautifully in Alaska, and that is that we have a prudent savings account, that we invest to strengthen and diversify our economy, and that we help Alaskans today. I think those should be the three goals, and I think that we currently are not doing that at all. I know we're not strengthening and diversifying the economy. I'm convinced we're not helping Alaskan today, except to the extent that you think a dividend does. And I don't think they're really